The views and opinions expressed by the host and tonight's guest are not necessarily those of this radio network, its affiliates, or its sponsors. Listener discretion is advised. Now lock your doors, open your minds, and prepare yourself to go
beyond the edge.
Good evening and welcome back to another edition of Beyond the Edge Radio. It's Creature Feature Night. It's November the 15th and welcome everybody to the program tonight. My name's Eric Altman, your host and producer of the show tonight. And with me, as always, my faithful sidekick, my partner in crime, the best co-hostess from the West Coastest, Marie Samuels. Do you like that?
That was good.
That was good. It's just off the cuff.
Very well done.
Marie is joining me tonight here on the program as she does each and every week. Not joining us tonight is Karen Dolan. I think maybe she got abducted by aliens at the UFO conference this week.
Well, hopefully they don't probe her.
Oh, that was bad.
You started
it. That was bad. Ooh. But yeah, she's not with us. Maybe she'll call in. We sent her a couple messages asking if she was going to join us, but so far, no answer. Maybe she doesn't have Wi-Fi in the hotel that she's at. I don't know. But
yep, that's probably the most likely explanation.
Yeah, but it's okay because you've got us. You've got Eric and Marie tonight, and you've got Nick Redfern joining us at the bottom of the hour at 8:30 tonight. It's going to be a humdinger of a show. We're going to be talking about Bigfoot, chupacabras, and Rh-negative blood types, aliens, all kinds of good stuff tonight on the show.
Yeah, and Nick Redfern is always such a fascinating guest to have on. So I mean, it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, it's going to be a great show tonight, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Nick. It's been a while since he's been on, but we'll have fun talking with him and pick his brain and talk about some of his latest books. And by the way, the chat room, if you're trying to get into the chat room tonight, apparently it's still messed up. They're still having problems with X-Chat, or whatever they call it, X-A-T chat. But if you go over to the Para-X website, there is a chat room there. If you can get in, good luck. I'm in there. I think Marie is in there, but I don't know.
I'm not.
Yeah, I don't know who's in there. Everybody's having trouble. So, and at any rate, you can go to our website, beyondtheedgeradio.com. Click on the Listen Live tab. There's a bunch of banners there on that page. I just set that up. So you can click on any of those banners. It'll take you to another page, which will allow you to listen to the show live. So there's quite a few options there to listen to the show tonight or any night. But tonight, we've got a great guest. As I said, Nick Redfern is joining us at the bottom of the hour, and look forward to talking to him. Next week on the show, one of our favorite programs is going to be heading your way as we welcome back Chris Nicastro. It's been a while since Chris has been on the show, probably since, I want to say, July, maybe.
Yeah, it's been quite a while.
Yeah, Chris will be back this coming Sunday, the 22nd, and we'll be discussing paranormal news and discussion with Marie, myself, and our paranormal news correspondent, Chris Nicastro. That's going to be a fun program, as always.
Yep.
Then rounding out the month, Jeff Belanger, our buddy Jeff, is back. Former host of 30-odd Minutes, which is no longer airing. He is working now with the PBS out of New England and doing a show on New England mysteries and hauntings and strange locations. He's an author, paranormal investigator, and he'll be joining us to talk about Christmas paranormal stories. So can't wait for that.
Perfect timing.
Yes. But tonight it's creature features. We're going to be talking about Bigfoot, chupacabras, men in black. And they're not really creatures, but I guess you could consider them creatures. Aliens from his book, Bloodline of the Gods. His new book, The Bigfoot Book, and Chupacabra Road Trip. We'll be discussing all that and more. So that comes your way in just a little bit. I wanted to throw this announcement out there real quick before we talk about some paranormal news and some things in the headline news. First of all, let me send out our condolences to the folks in Paris that suffered this horrible tragedy this weekend, the terrorist attacks from ISIS that killed over 100, and I believe it was 150 people, and injured 350 people.
Yeah, I think the death toll is at like 129 right now.
Okay. Well,
but 99 are in critical condition of the 352 that were injured.
Wow, it's terrible news. Apparently, most of them were killed when they were attending a rock concert in Paris, and by suicide bombers and being shot, and just a horrible tragedy. So we want to send our condolences, our prayers, our thoughts, and our good vibes out to the folks in France and in Paris and around the world who are suffering from these ISIS attacks. Hopefully somebody will get to the bottom of this and take care of them once and for all.
Yeah, something needs to be done for sure. Yeah. These guys are out of control.
Big time. So we're with you, France, and hopefully those people that are in the hospital and recovering will make a speedy recovery. And to the families and friends of those who were tragically killed this weekend, we send our prayers. The other announcements I wanted to throw out there, there is a big event coming up in the spring of 2015. Or 2016, excuse me, something that I'm putting together. And I mentioned this briefly on the show a couple weeks back, when I was running the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, I tried to put on two camping outings every year for the public and for members of the group who wanted to go out in the field and do some research and learn how to Bigfoot and stuff like that. But I haven't done it for a while, and I'm no longer part of the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, so I thought it'd be kind of a cool idea to throw something together, so that's what I've done. It's a weekend trip taking place May 6th, 7th, and 8th of 2016. It is the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure. It is taking place in southwestern Pennsylvania in Fayette County, a little town called Farmington, Pennsylvania. And if you give me just a second here, I'm pulling up the details as we're talking right now. It's going to be a really cool weekend because we're looking at guest speakers. We're looking at workshops, hikes, outings, all kinds of fun stuff. The website is pabigfootcampingadventure.weebly.com. That's pabigfootcampingadventure.weebly.com. Or just message me on Facebook. I'll give you all the details. But as I said, taking place May 6th, 7th, and 8th of 2016. It'll take place in Farmington, Pennsylvania, which is in the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania. The campground is Benner's Meadow Run. That's Benner's Meadow Run, and the website's bennersmeadowrun.com. And what the weekend will entail is it's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday event. Friday people will check in the afternoon. There will be an afternoon Bigfoot hike and then a Friday night Bigfoot outing. Into some pretty active areas in Pennsylvania where there have been sightings, a lot of sightings and reports and claims and encounters. And we'll take people out into the forest and put them in groups, and they can hike through the woods at night and look for Bigfoot. Then Saturday, there will be lectures taking place starting at 10 a.m. Right now we have two lecturers lined up with a third. We're on standby with, we're waiting to hear back from him, confirmation. But the first lecturer is a UFO Bigfoot researcher, Stan Gordon. And his information is at stangordon.info. That's his website, www.stangordon.info. And Dr. Brian Parsons, he hails from Ohio. He is a cryptozoologist, a paranormal researcher, and a really cool guy. He's done a lot of lecturing. He'll be coming in as well to talk about cryptozoology and Bigfoot and his take on the subject. And then we've got workshops going on after the speakers, which will include Dwayne Pintoff and Tom Ference. They'll be talking about Bigfoot activity, investigations they've taken part of, and how to identify Bigfoot evidence, what to look for, what signs to look for, how to rule out what isn't Bigfoot evidence, because a lot of people don't know what to exactly look for out there. So Dwayne and Tom will be hosting a joint workshop together. Ranger Tim Cassidy will be there. He's a park ranger and a wildlife biologist, and he'll be talking about what signs to look for, tracks, how to identify tracks, how to identify animal sounds, how to identify animal sign, and he'll also be talking about safety in the field when you're doing Bigfoot research. And then last but not least, I'll be doing a workshop on how to make Bigfoot plaster castings, because a lot of people don't know how to do that, and I've done my share over the years, so I'll be trying to teach people how to make Bigfoot casts, and what proper materials to use, and it'll be a lot of fun. People will actually be able to get their hands in the plaster of Paris, mix it up, and make a big mess. So those are the tentative speakers and the tentative workshop set up for the event. And then following the speakers and the workshop, we're going to have a Bigfoot cookout. And no, we're not cooking Bigfoot. it's a cookout that everybody's going to be taking part in. Hot dogs, hamburgers, picnic food, sodas, water, that sort of thing. And everybody that attends the speakers, lectures, and the workshops will be able to attend the cookout. Now, the price for all this, I'm keeping it as cheap as I possibly can. What the people are going to do that want to attend is they'll have to contact Benner's Run Meadow Campgrounds, which is the campground we're camping at. We have a group campsite. It's Benner's Meadow Run Campgrounds. You can contact them off that website I gave you, and I'll give that out again here in a second. But you will pay for your own campsite. It's $13 per night per adult, or $650 per night per youth or child, anybody under 18. And you'll make your reservation to the campground, let them know that you want to camp at Eric Altman's site, which is the group campsite I'm reserving, and you'll directly pay for the camping in staying there yourself. Now, you can also reserve a cabin, or you can stay in one of the local hotels. All that information is on the website. To attend the lectures and the workshops and the cookout, that's only $20. You can make payment to me on the website. Just send it to PayPal or check or money order, made payable to me. And that covers the cost of the lecturers coming in, their expenses, paying for their campsites, and all the food and beverages for the cookout. So I'm not making any profit off of it. We're taking care of the speakers. We're taking care of paying for the pavilion, and we're taking care of the food and drinks. Anything that's made over after everybody's paid and taken care of will be donated to one of the local animal shelters. So I'm not trying to make a profit off of it. I just want to have a nice event, pay for some decent speakers to come in, take care of their expenses, pay for a nice cookout, the pavilion, and that's really all I'm looking to accomplish. Again, the website address is pabigfootcampingadventure.weebly.com. pabigfootcampingadventure.weebly.com, or if you just go to a search browser and type in Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure, you'll find the link to the website. But it's taking place May 6th, 7th, and 8th of 2016. Tickets are already starting to sell. I'm getting a flood of people asking about it, asking for more information. Everything is on the website, maps, directions, campsite information, speakers, workshops, how to purchase your tickets, how to contact me if you have any questions. It's all right there. So check it out, and hopefully we'll see everybody in May for the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure.
I have a question about the cabins.
Sure.
Do they have showers?
I believe they do. I believe they do. They're pretty nice looking cabins.
You know, being the diva that I'm not, I need to take a shower.
Well, I know the campgrounds actually do have public showers and public restrooms with running water. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I think the cabins do. I think they have toilets, running water, showers, all accommodations, furniture, bedding. They're pretty nice cabins. But check out their website. If you go to that website, Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure, there's a link there for Benner's. Or you can just go to bennersmeadowrun.com. Again, Benner, B-E-N-N-E-R-S, meadowrun.com. And you can check out the pictures of the campgrounds. It's a really cool place. And it's right in the heart of Bigfoot territory in Pennsylvania. So,
yeah, I'm going to really try and make it. So,
I think you and your husband would have a great time.
Yeah, really absolutely. Just hanging out with you, period, would be a great time. But then to have this whole event going on is even better. So
it would be crazy.
I'm really going to try and make it happen, Eric. I'm looking forward to it.
It would be a lot of fun if you could make it down. We'd have a blast, and I think we'd probably get in some trouble. Stir up some Bigfoots.
No probably about it.
Yeah. But that's the big announcement I wanted to make as far as the events coming up. And, of course, like I said, Nick Redfern is joining us tonight. And we've got a couple paranormal news stories. So if you want to go ahead and cover those, Marie, we can talk about those couple of stories before we go to break.
Okay. The first one, did woman see Bigfoot in Sussex Downs? Dog walker tells of close encounter with hairy ape man who ran past her deep in the woods. Caroline Toms, 34, took this grainy photo of a huge Bigfoot she claims ran past her in the woods. She was confronted by the terrifying beast, covered head to toe in thick black fur and crouching upright like a man, as she walked her border collie, Ash. The building society worker said, "It all happened so fast. Ash started acting a little bit bemused and barking." I gotta be careful with that dog's name. "Then she shot off into the undergrowth and I saw this big black thing. What it was, but when I had a closer look at the pictures, it certainly does look like a Bigfoot to me. The close encounter of the furred kind..." I've never heard of that before.
Wow.
"The close encounter of the furred kind." That's clever. Bring on the mashed potatoes, brother. Yeah. happened at Anmering Park Estate in Arundel, West Sussex. Caroline of nearby Littlehampton said the beast resembles the legendary Bigfoot ape man of North America, also known as the Sasquatch. She said, "I think it could be Bigfoot, but it happened so fast I cannot be absolutely certain. It was just luck that I had the camera out. It was so big and massive, I don't know if it could be anything else. That's what it looked like. I don't know for sure, but I've seen other pictures of supposed Bigfoot, and what I saw looks like the other ones." The 6,750-acre Anmering Park Estate is a private nature reserve set in the heart of the South Downs National Park. It is also a hot spot for big cat sightings. The Sussex Big Cat Watch Group claims there have been countless sightings of a puma or leopard over the years. In September 2009, a walker, not a walker from The Walking Dead, but a walker, claimed to have seen a big black cat the size of a small Labrador walk in front of him on the edge of a dense forest. There have been scores of Bigfoot sightings in the USA, including the famous piece of film shot in a valley in California in 1967.
That was a pretty clever story.
It was clever, wasn't it?
Close Encounters.
That's one of the best written ones we've ever read.
Yeah, Close Encounters of the Furred Kind.
Right?
Yeah, and the walker.
And the walker.
Yeah, I was waiting for the walker to say, "I saw Daryl." Where's Rick? Anyhow, we got a new story out of Kentucky. You want me to read this one?
Sure.
All right, this one comes from Kentucky, where a resident says he was able to take two pictures of a creature he said resembled a Bigfoot. The man who didn't provide a name said he spotted the animal next to a field in an undisclosed wooded area. The sighting was reported to Thomas Markham, founder of the Crypto Crew, last week. Markham says the eyewitness is a credible person and that the sighting occurred on the evening of November 2nd. Reportedly, the man used his cell phone to take two photographs. The photographs, which Markham says were cropped in order to hide the location of the eyewitness, show a dark, blurry figure standing next to a tree. "The pictures were taken from a long distance," said Markham. The witness said the figure was moving to the right, and the researcher added that he and his team immediately conducted an investigation and that evidence was quickly found. It was in the form of tree breaks. The area has a recent history of Bigfoot sightings, so we have a reason to believe that the creature still might be in the area. The photographer did not provide a physical description of the purported creature and did not specify the duration of the sighting. Markham goes on to say he claims over 20 years' experience researching the paranormal and also released an audio file containing the sound of what he believes could be the same animal. The researcher said his team will continue their efforts with the investigation for a few more days. And if you remember last August, a woman claimed to have seen a red Bigfoot in the middle of a Kentucky road holding a baby.
That's right, the baby.
Yep. So apparently they're seeing Bigfoot down there in Kentucky quite a bit these days.
Yeah, and that's what the next story is, too.
I think it's the same story, actually.
Oh, is it?
I think so. Yeah, it is the same story.
Okay.
All right, so we'll skip that one.
I was like, whoa, there was another one.
Yeah.
Let's go to Kentucky right now.
Oh, you want to handle the last one from Oklahoma?
Yeah, the hunt for Bigfoot in Oklahoma.
Where the wind comes sweeping down the plains. Sorry.
Keep going.
No, I don't know the words to the song. I'm making it up as I go along.
The hunt for Bigfoot in Oklahoma. Some have hunted it, others have encountered it. But many don't believe it exists. We're talking about Bigfoot, and hundreds of hunters worldwide believe this mysterious creature exists. So, News 9 went along on a Bigfoot exhibition here in Oklahoma to see for ourselves. Under the tall trees of southeast Oklahoma, the slightest shake of a bush lures curious campers. We've caught all sorts of sounds that we can't attribute to known animals, said Randy Savig with the Missouri chapter of the Mid-American Bigfoot Research Center, each driven to explain something they can't. I really wasn't looking for it, it just happened, said D.W. Lee, the executive director for the MABRC. Something big and hairy runs right across my headlights, remembers Rob Johnson, a former high school wrestling coach. This dark, gray, grayish thing just kind of stood up, Savig said. I was looking through a night vision scope, recalls Lee, and he popped up and looked at us for a couple of seconds, and then it went down and rose back up and looked at us again, and called crazy plenty of times. I just take it in stride, Lee said. Lee claims that the MABRC has 500 members worldwide, all of them steadfast in their belief in the existence of Bigfoot. Many claim to have heard the creature. It's just a big screaming monkey the way I see it, Lee said. Some have claimed to have seen it, taking pictures, which seem to be a bit unclear. They look like a gorilla, but they walk on two legs just like we do, Lee said. They know to stay away from anything that can harm them. I don't go hunt Bigfoot. I research Bigfoot. There's a difference, Johnson said. During the day, parabolic microphones and infrared cameras get set up, but it's under the moonlight that they leave camp to explore, making as much noise as they can with the hope that the curiosity will bring out the Bigfoot. Some of the guys will ride these trails throughout the night on ATVs, while others are more methodical, mapping out the terrain on foot. But on this night, strategies to lure the mystical creature fall short, but at the campfire stories of past encounters always endure. Morning brings another opportunity to prove what everyone here already believes. It's a mystery, Johnson said. I'm here not to solve the mystery. I want to be part of the history.
Well, it was an interesting article, what we heard of it.
Yeah, I heard myself in again, so I figured I'd cut out.
Yeah, a couple of times. It's Skype tonight. It keeps losing the internet connection, so who knows. Maybe it's the hackers who hacked the chat room last week.
Maybe.
I think they're up to no good. Or it could be the Men in Black.
Could be.
It could be the Men in Black. We'll be talking a little bit about them tonight with our guest, Nick Redfern.
Get him on.
Yeah, we're going to have to get him on, definitely. But Skype's acting up, and the chat room's acting up, and it's going to be a fun night tonight.
Yeah, hang in there with us, gang. We're doing our best.
Yeah. Karen Dolan is not with us this evening. I think the aliens may have abducted her, and she did go to a UFO conference, so might explain it.
It's a theory.
Yeah. That's what we're full of. And we're full of it, believe me. At any rate, a little bit about Nick. If you want to find out more about him, you can go to his website. Go to our website, beyondtheedgeradio.com, and there is a link for his website on our main page, which is you can go to nickredfernfortian.blogspot.com. He also has a couple other websites set up, nickredfernbooks.blogspot.com, anomalousbooks.com/Redfern, He has been writing forever, it seems. He's been doing this for a long time. He's originally hails from England, in the UK. I believe he's from Walsall, Staffordshire. And he is now residing in Texas, over here in the U.S. He writes on all kinds of phenomenon, from UFOs to cryptids to conspiracies to aliens to ghosts and hauntings. He pretty much covers it all, Marie.
Yeah, he does, and that's what makes him so epic.
Yeah, and he's just put out a bunch of books, like, within the last 2 months. I was looking at his page the other day, and it's actually amazing the stuff that he's released since September. Just a quick rundown of that. He's got Men in Black, Personal Stories and Eerie Adventures, Die Echten Men in Black, which I believe is the German translation that he released in September, MIB, the Brazilian edition of that book. He's released the Bigfoot book, the Encyclopedia of Sasquatch, Yeti, and Cryptid Primates, which I want to get a copy of. His publisher was kind enough to send me a copy of Chupacabra Road Trip, In Search of the Elusive Beast, which came out in September as well. I have not had a chance to read that yet. My schedule is just chaotic. He also released in August a copy that you got a copy of, Bloodline of the Gods. Mm-hmm. He released a bunch of books in May and March, Secret History, Conspiracies from Ancient Aliens to New World Order, Top Secret Government Archives, Missing Files and Conspiracy Paper Trails. He just puts out books all the time.
I know, he's churning and burning.
Yeah, and he lectures too. He travels to a bunch of different events and lectures, and plus he researches. So the man is never not busy. I don't think he takes
a break. I couldn't imagine.
I don't think he takes a break. I think he just goes. I think he just goes. But he's going to be coming on the show here in just a few minutes. So we'll go ahead and take our bottom of the hour break and take care of some sponsors. And when we come back, we'll have author, 14 investigator, and our good buddy Nick Redford joining us on the show. You're listening to BTE Creature Features here on the Para X Radio Network, IRN, the Internet Radio Network, WAHR-FM, Radio Love, Planet Paranormal, and TuneIn Radio. And you can hear the rebroadcast of our shows Wednesday nights from 7 to 9 Eastern Time on IPBN-FM. That's the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcast Network. Marie and Eric will be back after the break with our special guest tonight, Nick Redfern. Stick around.
What strange creatures lurk in the darkness? We do. BTE Radio's Creature Features will be right back.
Every week you visited the website, our Facebook page, and joined us in the chat room. You've tuned in to hear the best in alternative talk radio. We've heard your cries for more, and now you can take your BTE radio experience beyond the edge. Step out of the darkness and into the spotlight with your own BTE swag. The new BTE Radio online store is now open for business and offers a wide variety of men and women's clothing, collectible items, and cool gear, all with the BTE logo on it and all at affordable prices. The new BTE Radio online store is now your one-stop shop for all your cool BTE swag. Check out the new BTE Radio online store at cafepress.com/BTE gear or go to the BTE website at beyondtheedgeradio.com and click on the BTE Radio online store banner on the homepage. All sales and proceeds go to keeping your favorite alternative talk radio show on the air and coming into your home each and every week. So what are you waiting for? Be one of the cool kids on the block and help support Beyond the Edge Radio by visiting the new BTE Radio online store. For high quality, affordable BTE apparel, gear, and accessories, there's nowhere else to go but to the new BTE online radio shop right now and help get your BTE bling on.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Have you ever wanted to spruce up the marketing material for your business? Have you ever wanted to turn those memories you have on slides or VHS tapes into DVDs? Have you ever wanted to create the perfect personalized video for a loved one? Then look no further. The sky is the limit with Chumbucket Studios. Anything is possible because it all begins with a little imagination. Please visit www.chumbucketstudios.com.
Great party, huh, guys?
Yeah, this is so great.
I do say so myself. Hey, did you know that birthday parties actually help build confidence in kids?
Yeah, I did know that.
Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Right, of course.
Yeah, I knew that. Did you know that strollers have the right of way on sidewalks?
Oh, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, that's true. Did you know that friendly kids statistically have more friends?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah, so obvious.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
I think I knew that.
No, you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Even that restraining order couldn't keep us away. BTE Radio's Creature Features is back.
Of the Moon Rays. It's called Blues for Vampira. I like that song, Marie. That's pretty laid back and kind of spooky. Good stuff. And I think we lost Marie again. Yeah, it's Skype. I'm telling you, the Men in Black are with us tonight. And they heard that Nick Redfern was going to be on the show, so they had to make a guest appearance and kind of screw up our Skype account and ruin things. But that's okay. We'll get through it. We do each and every week. As I said, tonight's guest is Nick Redfern. He really needs no introduction. He's been on the show with us multiple times. He is a very well-known author, investigator, good guy, good friend of the show. Nick, welcome back. Thanks for joining us again tonight on the program.
Hey, Eric. How's it going?
Good, my friend. Glad to have you back with us. Glad to talk with you once again. And actually, this is your first appearance on BTE's Creature Features. It's a new segment we do every month.
But I've done the show several times.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Many times.
You get me confused then.
Yeah, this is actually like it's still part of the show, but every month we call it Creature Features because we feature one particular episode that looks at cryptids and creatures and strange animals and stuff like that. So we haven't had you on this particular segment, but you've been part of the show as a guest, and you were a segment host for a while. A couple years back, you hosted Nick Redfern's Paranormal World with us for a while. So we're glad you're with us tonight. Before we had you come on just before the break, we were talking about how busy you are with everything going on, all your books and your lectures, your appearances, and all that stuff that you have going on in your life. And you told me something pretty interesting, and I'm sure our listeners would probably get a kick out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually have four books out right now. Two on cryptozoology, one called the Bigfoot book, which is like an A to Z book of everything to do with Bigfoot. The Chupacabra Road Trip, which is like, as the title suggests, sort of a road trip style study of all the investigations done into the Chupacabra. A new book on the Men in Black, which is my third one, called Men in Black. And then an ancient astronaut type book called Bloodline of the Gods. But people often think I'm one of these sort of people who, you know, sort of 24/7, I'm sort of writing and sort of, you know, wide awake on caffeine and who knows what else, you know, to keep me going. But it's actually not like that. I sort of typically like, although, you know, everything I do is, I'm very passionate about it, and, you know, but I also like to keep sort of what I call job hours. So I work 8 to 5 Monday to Friday. I take evenings off and weekends off because, you know, if I didn't, I'd get burned out. But people say, well, how can you write 4 books, you know, and have more come out together, you know, if you're just doing 8 to 5? But a lot of it comes down to the publishers. For example, the Men in Black book and the Chupacabra book pretty much came out both at the same time. But the Chupacabra book was actually, the writing was actually finished in October of last year. So we're talking about October of 2014. And the writing for the Men in Black book was finished in July 2015. So we're talking about a space of almost a year between the Chupacabra book being finished and the Men in Black book being finished. But what happened was that the Llewellyn, who published the Chupacabra book, decided to publish it almost like a year after I handed over the manuscript, whereas the Men in Black publisher, which is my agent's company, Lisa Hagen, they published it almost immediately. So in other words, you've got two books coming out together, but one was actually finished almost a year before the other one. You see what I mean?
Right.
And that was kind of the situation also with the Bigfoot book and the Bloodline of the Gods Ancient Astronauts book as well, that there was like a long space between completion. And it was just purely coincidence that all four different publishers put the books out between August and October of this year. But two of the books, you know, the Word documents were handed over, you know, sort of, well, one was almost 12 months ago, one was more than 12 months ago, you know. So it looks like I'm sort of burning the candle at every other end. But in reality, it just comes down to, you know, if the publisher has got 3 or 4 books ahead of mine, then mine gets bumped up a year down the line. But it doesn't mean I'm writing it down a year down the line. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. And that's what I kind of figured is that, as you said, we talked about this last year when we had dinner together.
Yeah.
You said, I work Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and then I have my weekends off and I have time for myself, which makes sense. You're writing 5 days a week, but you're not writing like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You get one book done, send it to the publisher. It takes their time to get it out. And, you know, so that does make sense. But still,
For me, like I said, it's a passion, and I love what I do. And I think, you know, I think that's the only way to do it. It's like all of us, whether it's Bigfoot or UFO research, whatever, you've got to be passionate about it.
Right.
But there's also, I think, you know, the danger that you can get burned out. And for me, you know, I think when you write in particular, you can get burned out. So that's why I like to sort of, you know, I get up sort of 6:37, have breakfast, check email, Facebook, Twitter, do a couple of blog posts, then I start working 8 in the morning till 5. 5 o'clock comes round, you know, I finish a sentence, shut the Word document down, and then, you know, Monday night might be a soccer game, you know, Wednesday night, take a girlfriend out to see a band, Saturday night, you know, could be, you know, just out with friends down the pub or whatever, and, you know, Sunday nights, catching up on all the TV shows I've recorded over the past week. And that's you know, that's sort of my big thing, sort of music, soccer, things like that, and just having a good time. And I think, you know, when you, particularly doing something like writing, if you do get burned out, then you don't do your sort of best writing, and you just inevitably have to go back and rewrite it, and you think, oh, well, I should have done this better, and this just doesn't look good, you know. So I think it's important to have that free, all that time away, so you just don't get frazzled, you know.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we're glad you're with us tonight to share these really interesting books. And you know, made my Christmas wish list a little longer this year, but that's okay. The wife's she's understanding. She knows that things happen. So I'll have a nice little stocking filled with your books this year, except for Chupacabra. I have to thank your publisher for sending me an advanced copy of that.
Oh, cool. I'm glad they sent that.
Yeah, I got a copy of that. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I will be once things slow down for me here, I'm going to sit down and start to read. So looking forward to that. So let's start off talking about the Chupacabra tonight. This is a subject that's surrounded by controversy, not only because of the creature itself, but because of what it's become here in the United States over the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
That's not where it started out, though. This started out in 1995, I believe it was.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the whole phenomenon, at least under that name, the Chupacabra, began in 1995 when ranchers and members of the public began reporting attacks predominantly on farm animals like chickens and goats. And the term Chupacabra is actually a Spanish term. It means goat sucker. And it was given the name because people were talking about their animals being attacked. And in some cases, there were rumors of blood being drained from them. So, you know, the term goat sucker was sort of a typical inevitable title almost. And it sort of provoked vampire-like imagery, you know, with the blood being drained. Now, bear in mind, 95, the internet was barely in existence back then. And so most of the information that we had to rely on was coming from, like, for example, newsletters, magazines, fanzines that existed back in those days. For people who don't understand what a magazine is, it's something with a glossy cover and staples.
What's that?
They're becoming less and less today. They're becoming less and less today, unfortunately, with everything being online. But yeah, so that was how it all kicked off. Now, the book itself, Chupacabra Road Trip, it's called Chupacabra Road Trip because it chronicles sort of 10 years of my on-the-road investigations into the Chupacabra. And I always feel, I'm sure like you, Eric, you know, when you're doing Bigfoot investigations, you can find a ton of material about Bigfoot on the net, but you're not going to find Bigfoot literally on the net. You've got to go out and investigate cases in the field, so to speak. And that's what I've done with the Chupacabra. The first time I went to Puerto Rico looking for the original Chupacabra was in 2004. And this was with a team from the Sci-Fi Channel for a new show that was being made at the time called Proof Positive. And it was sort of like the X-Files meets CSI, where they wanted some sort of forensic angle, you know, in terms of looking for the creatures and trying to determine about...
I think I remember that show.
Yes, footprints, DNA analysis, that kind of thing. The only downside was I didn't have like an Abby from NCIS to go with me, but you know, that's how it goes. So,
beggars can't be choosers.
So that was the first time I went, and I've been to Puerto Rico on many occasions now, and that's sort of over the course of the last 11 years. And going to Puerto Rico and meeting the witnesses and speaking to veterinarians, police officers, civil defense workers, all who had some sort of input on the investigation, sort of really opened my eyes to the idea that, wow, you know, this isn't just, you know, friend of a friend stuff or mythology or local folklore. It's a real phenomenon.
Do we lose you, Nick?
No.
Okay, I thought we lost you.
No, I just took a break in case you wanted to chime in.
Skype's been kind of acting up tonight, and I was like, oh, I think we lost him. It's an interesting subject because it started in 95 where people were seeing this alien-looking figure that ran around on two legs. It was about 3 or 4 foot tall, as you said, covered in scales, had spikes down its back, fangs, claws, more like a lizard kind of looking thing or an alien-looking thing. And
well, yeah, right. I mean, you just pretty much described what people said, you know, the sort of bipedal, spikes down its neck. In some cases, witnesses even reported the creature having sort of bat-like wings, you know, not feathery wings like a bird, but sort of like a typical bat, you know, sort of membrane-type wings, that sort of thing. So we're clearly dealing with, you know, some sort of unknown animal. And certainly most of the reports that I got when I went over there for the first time in 2004 did fit that category. You know, it was described by a couple of the people as sort of like a hairless chimpanzee in terms of its size and its speed and its sort of muscle strength and everything else, except for the fact that the color was more sort of a greeny-gray color with these spikes. But, mm-hmm. you know, the build was kind of like a typical chimpanzee, where it mainly ran along, I mean, or I should say it could run along on, you know, two legs, but also for speed it could sort of race along on four as well. But what was interesting was that even on the very first occasion that I went there, I got reports from people who said that, well, although the term chupacabra didn't exist prior to 1995, that they'd had encounters with very similar things, if not identical things, years earlier. For example, one of the people we interviewed for the show was a woman named Norca. She lived high in the El Yunque rainforests on Puerto Rico. The El Yunque rainforest is this huge, I mean, it's a gigantic rainforest. You know, if you were sort of parachuted in blindfolded, you'd think you'd just flown into like the Amazon jungle or something like that. That's how big and expansive it is. Mm-hmm. And this woman, Norca, she'd had an encounter way back in 1975 with a creature that literally sort of shuffled across the road in front of her, which was she described as almost identical to what people were saying with the chupacabra. It was sort of bipedal, had these vicious-looking fangs and talons and large wings. But, of course, you know, that back in 75, that term simply didn't exist, you know, chupacabra. What's interesting is that outside of the El Yunque rainforest, but also in 75, in an area of Puerto Rico called Moca, there were reports of what became known as the Moca vampire. And if you Google Moca vampire, you'll find a number of interesting stories about this wave of attacks on animals and alleged blood draining in 75. But if you look at the reports, the Moca vampire sounds just like the chupacabra. In other words, what I think's happened is that this actually isn't a relatively new phenomenon. What I think is with the rise of, you know, the interest in paranormal magazines, and particularly the internet, the story began to circulate outside of Puerto Rico. But if you go to Puerto Rico and speak to the people and gain their confidence and trust, then they start opening up and say, well, you know, we heard all about this decades earlier, but we didn't just, you know, there was nobody to tell. You know, it wasn't like there was an internet, people didn't have blogs, there was no UFO researchers running around collecting reports and publishing them. So they, you know, it's sort of a case that the stories just didn't leave Puerto Rico, and they went under the radar, so to speak.
Now, some of the reports that I've read, this goes back years that I've read different reports, is this thing was amazingly fast, and it could bound much like a kangaroo or even further. And there were farmers that were catching glimpses of this thing. And I'm curious to know, with it being as fast as they reported it to be, or being able to bound away pretty quickly and never be captured, was there any solid physical proof ever collected proving this animal did in fact or does in fact exist?
Mm. Well, that's the big question. It's like a lot of so many cryptids, you know, we get really credible witness testimony, but the big problem is in many cases, apart from like Bigfoot where we get sort of, you know, calls and screams and footprints, you know, a lot of these cryptids, we don't find physical evidence. And for the most part, that has been the case with the chupacabra. Now, I will say that some of the ranchers I spoke to actually did had the presence of mind to photograph prints of some of these animals. And the problem was that, you know, sometimes the pictures were taken after a couple of days, and Puerto Rico has a lot of heavy rain, you know, like monsoon-type rain. And so tracks and prints can sometimes get, you know, sort of altered or mutated when the rain gets on the ground and, you know, it starts to expand and move and so on. I mean, it's like a lot of cases. A witness testimony to me, you know, is important. I mean, the witnesses are arguably the most important people in the subject, because without them, we've got nothing really to go on. And, I mean, when you're talking about ranchers, one of the cases that I investigated in 2004 was a rancher who lived high in the hills of Puerto Rico, and he bred peacocks, not for any other reason, that he liked peacocks. You know, essentially they were pets. And there are a couple of occasions where he woke up in the middle of the night to his peacocks, you know, making a lot of noise. And if you've ever heard a peacock, they can make a hell of a lot of noise. And he raced down to the ranch, which was sort of at the far end of his house, this big house in the hills. And fortunately, he got there before, you know, the animals were attacked and killed. But he described how he ran out with his flashlight and caught sight of this weird-looking animal, about 4 feet tall, that sort of swayed on its hind legs. But he had this notable sort of line of spikes down its head and neck. And he was sort of, I mean, he was literally terrified. And he said it sort of shot out of the field through this hole it had made in the fence. And he staked out this particular area over the course of 3 nights and saw it a couple of times again, tried to shoot it, but didn't manage to. But he was, you know, he was adamant that this was no normal animal. And fortunately for him and fortunately for the peacocks, the attacks came to an end. But, of course, you know, when it comes to evidence, you know, one of the things I found on Puerto Rico very quickly is that, unfortunately, a lot of the people are quite poor. So, you know, if you imagine a rancher who's reliant on, you know, selling a few pigs and chickens here and there to support his family, well, he's probably not going to bother taking pictures or making plastic casts in the hope some monster hunter's one day going to turn up. You know, they're more, you know, concerned about, as I said, putting food on the table. So I think one of the main reasons why we don't have too much evidence is because, for reasons which are fully understandable, nobody's taken the time to collect that kind of evidence, if you see what I mean.
So aside from yourself, there have been very few people investigating the original Chupacabra claims in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and I think it's because a lot of it just comes down to, firstly, you've got to get out there. I mean, like even for me, most of the trips I've made out to Puerto Rico, they've typically all been about at least a week, maybe a little bit more, 8 or 9 days at a time. And we're talking 7 or 8 trips in total. So, you know, we're talking 60, 70 days altogether over the course of 10 years. But most of those have been in conjunction with, not all of them, but most of them with TV shows. So, in other words, you know, I probably wouldn't have been able to do half of those had it not been for the fact that a TV company was funding them, the expeditions. So, in other words, that's one of the problems, is just the logistics of the average cryptozoologist being able to spend that much time out there and looking for these things. You know, it's not that easy. You know, we all have to earn a living. We all have, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so it can be a bit of a problem. But in saying that, I think when you get out there, that's when you realize the sheer scale of the phenomenon. You realize that it's a genuine phenomenon. And the more you're out there, you know, you retain contacts for the next time you go. That's what I found, is that people, you know, they remember you from the previous time. They're like, hey, you know, we've got a few more leads for you. Here's, you know, a guy you need to speak to. And so you rent a car and just drive over there and sit with them and explain what you're doing. And when you do that, you know, I think in today's world, like I said jokingly early with the internet, I think people think if it's not on the internet, it hasn't happened, or yeah, people don't know about it. But I do find a lot of people, particularly on Puerto Rico, they just don't feel any need to post their stories, because, like I said, they've got lives to live and food to put on the table. They're not bothered about whether or not somebody knows about the story. If somebody comes asking, they'll tell them. But that's a very different thing.
Sure, sure. Now, when I first started asking you about the chupacabra, I mentioned it's a very controversial thing. As we know, well, A, because of the creature that was first reported in 95, if not earlier, but things kind of took a strange and weird twist in maybe the last 5 or 10 years, where we moved into the United States, southern Texas, the Gulf Coast states. We're starting to get these reports of these canines, blue dogs, koi dogs, whatever you want to call them, and they were basically dogs with mange, and people started calling them chupacabras, which is completely different than what people were reporting in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, you're right. You're totally right, Eric. That's a very important issue, because what's happened is that the term chupacabra has become sort of so iconic that any kind of weird-looking animal, people are like, oh, it's a chupacabra. I've had people who've photographed like a possum with mange, or something along those lines. And it's clearly a possum with mange. It's not the chupacabra or a chupacabra. Now, what happened was that about 2004, and particularly in the Southwest, and it really all sort of kicked off in South Texas, sort of the Austin, San Antonio area, which, when I first came over to live in the U.S., I live in Texas, just outside Dallas. I mean, like a lot of people who live overseas, you think Texas is just all desert. But much of Texas is heavily forested, particularly the east side of Texas. And certainly around San Antonio and Austin, there's a tremendous amount of forest land and fields and, wildlife, etc. And so what you had was this situation where people were seeing these animals, which before anybody knew what they were, they looked in the photographs where people, ranchers had shot them or they'd been hit by cars. They looked like giant hairless rats or something like that.
Yeah.
And, that's, people said, well, what are they? And it coincided with, these animals, whatever they were attacking farm animals. And in the early days, there were rumors that some of these animals were allegedly drinking the blood of the Texas farm animals they were attacking. Now, what happened was that when one of these animals were killed and pictures were taken of them, they were shown to various people around San Antonio and in particularly the San Antonio area, in some of the local markets, where there was a heavy Mexican component, which, San Antonio has a heavy Mexican population. Mm-hmm. And people were saying there, some of the Mexican people were saying, oh, well, this looks like, the chupacabra that people have been reporting, this weird creature. And because the chupacabra was particularly in the late 90s when reports began to surface out of Mexico and Chile and places like that, it became sort of really part of like a Latin American phenomenon, so they took more notice. However, it was clear that pretty much from the outset, when we started to have the ability to autopsy these animals and check the DNA, that they were canine. For the most part, they were coyotes. There were some coyotes mixed with regular dogs, some with wild wolves. There are even a couple mixed with Mexican wolves as well. But for the most part, the DNA was coming back as coyote. But they looked weird because they were totally hairless. Now, although, that kind of suggests a down-to-earth explanation, but it's not quite that simple. I mean, it never usually is in these type of situations. But these animals, one of the reasons they look so weird is because they're completely hairless. And I mean, like uniformly hairless. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at, most wild animals with mange, which is a condition caused by a mite, which, causes intense irritation and hair loss, and the animals scratch themselves because, they're so in so much pain and irritation. It's kind of like the human equivalent in terms of how it feels, like when you're a kid and you get chicken pox.
Yeah.
You just itch and you just want to scratch, and, you're told, well, don't scratch because it'll leave scars, that kind of thing. But animals with mange, they do scratch and cut themselves to the point where infection sets in, they get sick, they look ill, and they die very often. But these animals aren't showing the typical kind of things we see in regular mange, which is where you have the hair loss in tufts. You know, there's a patch here of hair, then there's a, you know, there's a bald patch, then there's hair, etc., etc. These animals are completely lacking in hair. Now, on top of that, a lot of them have like a significant overbite of about 3/4 of an inch, rather than having, you know, the top jaw and the bottom jaw sort of coming together. There have been a lot of reports where these animals, their front limbs seem to be developing at a shorter length than is normal. So they have this weird hopping movement. And to just give people sort of an example of this, what makes it even weirder is that some people have said that they've actually seen these things sort of hopping on their hind legs, as well as sort of having this weird hopping kangaroo-like movement. Now, just as a quick aside, in 2010, I traveled up to Oklahoma with Fox News, where there'd been a sighting there, and a young guy who had seen one of these creatures named Ryan Craighead photographed one of these things. And if you Google Ryan Craighead, C-R-A-I-G-H-E-A-D, a plush chupacabra, you'll see Ryan's picture of this weird, so clearly hairless animal bounding along on its hind legs, you know, a canine on its hind legs, with these ridiculously little front limbs just hanging as it's bouncing along. And so, you know, we're seeing what seems to be a spontaneous or relatively spontaneous mutation in the local coyote population, particularly around San Antonio and Austin. Now, one of the people I interviewed for the book was a good friend of mine, I'm sure you know, Ken Gerhard.
Yep.
And Ken has done extensive research into the so-called Texas Chupacabra. Ken's found that a lot of the sightings occur around coal-burning facilities. Now, one of the things given off by coal-burning facilities is sulfur dioxide, which is a mutagen. A mutagen is a substance which can cause disastrous changes in an animal at a genetic level. It's like if a woman gets pregnant and she ingests mercury. Mercury is probably one of the most disastrous mutagens of all. It can cause terrible deformities in the, you know, the human fetus as it grows. And that's the same for any animals. It's actually a story from 1995 in a Minnesota lake where frogs were being born with all sorts of deformities like extra limbs, extra eyes, but they were all sort of, they all worked. The extra eye worked, the extra limbs were functioning. And it was a very sort of disturbing situation to see these freakish frogs. And Ken has made a connection between, as I said, mutagen release in Texas and the sighting and the location sightings of these weird coyotes. So this has sort of led Ken to believe that we could be seeing some sort of pollutant mutation in pockets of the coyote population in Texas and elsewhere, which are now spreading and breeding, and, you know, their offspring are looking the same. And, you know, so they're not technically, they're clearly not the Puerto Rican chupacabra, but they've become, I guess, like the American chupacabra. But they're not just anything as sort of down-to-earth as hairless coyote. There's something much weirder going on as well.
It's a fascinating subject, and yeah, the media's picked up on it. You see these chupacabra sightings and reported shootings and road kills. They're popping up a lot more frequently than they were in the, you know, the past when the original chupacabra came out, and they were talking about that in Puerto Rico. Now it's an American craze that people are seeing the chupacabra everywhere. They're all over the country now.
Yeah, and I mean, one other good thing that Ken, you know, made a very good point of, which a lot of people don't think of, if this was just mange, why is it that we weren't seeing these animals, you know, and on this scale, in, say, instead of just 2004, why weren't we seeing them in 1994 or 1984 or 74? Why is it they suddenly started to change and appear on a massive scale from sort of 2004 onwards? You know, and I think that's an important and a valid question to ask.
Yeah.
It does sort of suggest that something is changing. But, and, you know, people ask me, should we call it the chupacabra? Well, I'm not entirely sure. But as I said, the term chupacabra has become so iconic that it has you know, allowed for these creatures in Texas and Oklahoma and elsewhere, spreading particularly further outside the Southwest and to other parts of the U.S. I don't think, you know, we'll ever change the name. And people have suggested we should sort of call them blue dogs and things like this because they do have sort of a blue or gray skin. And, you know, and I think that that's sort of a cool name. But I don't think it's ever going to, you know, stop people calling it the Chupacabra because it has become so iconic. There's sort of no getting away from it now, I think.
I would agree with you. And that's a good point that Ken brings up. Very good point. The book is called Chupacabra Road Trip, and it's available on Nick's website, nickredfern14.blogspot.com, if you want to pick a copy of it up. There's a lot more information in it, and we just basically touched the tip of the iceberg tonight on that. But we have a lot of other things to talk about, so we're going to move on to our next subject. And before we do that, I want to remind everybody that you're listening to BTE Radio's Creature Features live here on the Para X Radio Network, IRN, the Internet Radio Network, WAHR-FM, Radio Love, Planet Paranormal, and TuneIn Radio. And you'll be hearing the rebroadcast of tonight's show on the IPBN-FM network. That's the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcast Network. Our guest tonight, Nick Redfern, and we're talking about his latest releases. We just got done talking about Chupacabra Road Trip. And Marie, I know you're chomping at the bit to talk about his book that you've interviewed him on, Macabre Moments, Bloodline of the Gods.
Yes. this book was interesting to me because I have Rh negative blood. And so Nick, can you just give us kind of a breakdown of what the book is about?
Well, yeah, sure. The book is a study of people who have what's called Rh negative blood. Now, roughly round about sort of 90 to 92% of the human population are what's called Rh positive. Now, that means our blood all contains a particular basically I'll describe it first so you have an understanding of the whole situation. What we have is a human population where, if you look at it from the United States, roughly around 90% of all Caucasians are what's called Rh positive. For African Americans, about 10% of them, 7 or 8% of them, are what's called Rh negative. In Caucasians, about 10%. In Asian Americans, it's around about 2 to 3%. So it's actually a small percentage of the population. But basically, being Rh negative means that you lack a particular antigen in the bloodstream, or what's called a protein. And the term Rh negative or Rh positive, Rh comes from the rhesus monkey, which is an animal which has a extremely compatible almost DNA profile with us. It's about 94% or thereabouts identical with the rhesus monkey. That's why a lot of investigations and studies of medicines for use on people are actually tried out first on the rhesus monkey because we're so close to them. Now, this sort of begs the question, if the theory of evolution is 100% correct, why is it that a very small percentage of the population lacks this particular antigen, this protein, that identifies them as being Rh positive? Why should there even be any Rh negatives? Arguably, we should all be the same. Now, you could look at this purely from the perspective of like a scientific biological anomaly, except for one interesting thing, that there are literally countless people in the UFO subject, far more than you would expect given the fact that roughly only around 10% of all Caucasians in the US are Rh negative. The number of people in the UFO field, abductees, contactees, witnesses, researchers, authors, the figure of Rh negatives in those areas is through the roof. It doesn't relate or parallel, you know, the percentages of people in general. So the more I looked into this, the more I found something that had very much sort of gone under the radar, the fact that there is this sort of deep and long-lasting connection between people who have this Rh negative blood. And one of the theories that's been put forward is that possibly in the distant past, various early humanoids. You know, today we're Homo sapiens, but it kind of freaks some people out sometimes to learn that there were actually different types of humans. You know, we weren't all Homo sapien at one point. You know, there was Cro-Magnon man, Neanderthal man. We had the revelations just a couple of months ago of another type of early man having been found. And so, in other words, we see this going on constantly. One of the theories is that possibly Cro-Magnon man may have been sort of genetically altered in the distant past by extraterrestrials. Because Cro-Magnon man, in a lot of the areas where we know Cro-Magnon man proliferated, particularly in parts of Spain and France, is where today there's a higher proliferation of people who are Rh negative. And what's interesting is that the Cro-Magnons very much surfaced out of nowhere. Their brains were bigger than ours. They were highly skilled artists. If you look at the you know, the cave paintings in France particularly, they had an understanding of astronomy. They understood the, you know, the implications of life and death. They had burial rites. So, you know, it really very much throws out the window this image of the people have a caveman, you know, sort of dressed in rags and carrying a club and dragging his wife back to the cave by the hair. You know, that's like a school type of image, you know, when you're 6 years old. But Cro-Magnon man was highly evolved and came out of nowhere. And so this has given rise amongst a lot of ancient astronauts, investigators, the idea that there could have been a genetic manipulation, and the fact that the Rh negative syndrome proliferates throughout ufology today suggests that, you know, there could be a tie-in with the whole genetic angle of things like abductions and things like that today.
Do you know of anybody, that abductees that are Rh negative?
Oh yeah, I mean, there's literally dozens and dozens alone that I've spoken to. I mean, I'll give you a good example. When the book came out in August, a lot of people contacted me via Facebook. You know, when I promoted it on Facebook, people either responded to the Facebook post or they private messaged me. And they were pretty much all along the lines of, wow, this is really interesting, because, they said they wanted to read the book because, first and foremost, they were Rh negative, but also they'd had lifelong fascinations with the UFO subject and then began to realize and see themselves almost mirrored in the pages of the book in terms of, you know, how they become interested in the subject. They were, you know, they're abductees since children, or they had contact cases, or even they exhibited some of the physical traits of the Rh negatives. For example, it's actually not just a case that the Rh negatives have this slightly different or significantly different blood. They actually have a higher than normal percentage of people who every year are born with an extra vertebra in their back. This is actually a phenomenon that occurs across all blood groups, but Rh negatives, they have a higher incidence of being born with an extra vertebra. Now, what's really interesting is if we go back to probably the most famous alien abduction case of all, the Betty and Barney Hill case of 1961. Betty and Barney were a married couple traveling from a vacation in Canada back home to New Hampshire late one night in September 61, and saw this weird light in the sky, which then appeared as it got closer to be some sort of object. Then from there, they had this sort of classic situation that so many people get in abductions, where there's a period of missing time, a sense of something significant happening on board a craft. Then they start to get bad dreams and nightmares. So they decided to have regressive hypnosis. And it turns out that Barney said, and bear in mind this was the early to mid-60s, he said that when the aliens, or whatever they were examining him, they kept running their fingers up and down his spine, and he felt with hindsight that they were counting his vertebra. Now, bear in mind, as I said, the early 60s, no one was talking about Rh negative blood in association with abductees, and certainly not with abductees and Rh negatives being born with extra vertebra. And yet Barney Hill himself was bringing this up sort of 53 years ago. And it's these kind of things, Marie, that sort of gets back to your question, where people have read the book or talking about it and say, oh, my God, you know, this totally relates to me, that, you know, I've had a fascination with this subject for years. And I got literally dozens and dozens of emails and messages and tweets and Facebook messages from people saying that, you know, they'd had abduction experiences, they didn't understand it, they didn't know why they were drawn to the subject. And sort of 95-96% of everybody writing to me was Rh negative. It was sort of bringing them, you know, bringing them all out.
We got an email from a listener. It's a little lengthy, but I'm going to go ahead and read it if it's okay with you.
Yeah.
She says, I am Rh negative. Both of my parents have witnessed UFOs in New York City alongside many other witnesses. At the onset of my first menses, it became clear something was physically wrong with me by the monthly level 9 pain I was experiencing. I saw a specialist who informed me of two things upon invasive exam and biopsies. Number one, I was exposed to high levels of radiation in utero. And number two, it's clear I've been pregnant several times. My parents can't explain how I was exposed to high levels of radiation prior to birth. Also, I have never been pregnant. Eventually, I had to have a full hysterectomy to rid myself of the pain caused by the high levels of radiation I was exposed to prior to birth. I have had a lifelong paranormal experiences. My whole family has. My UFO sighting didn't occur until I was in my mid to late 20s. I was not alone and have a witness. It approached us 3 times on a remote camping trip in Alaska. I used to pilot aircraft, so I know the difference. Your thoughts on the matter, Mr. Redfern?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because, I mean, it does sort of cover several components of the typical stories we get from people who are Rh negative. You know, the connection to the UFO phenomenon, even the, you know, the pregnancy angle, which I can understand, you know, is an area to sort of have to approach very, very, you know, sort of diplomatically and carefully because it can be quite traumatic for a lot of people. But, I mean, there are a lot of stories of women being Rh negative, becoming pregnant, and then reportedly sort of losing the baby, but then there was no evidence of like a miscarriage. And a lot of, granted the stories are controversial, but they're more along the lines of as if the fetus was sort of, was removed in sort of very, you know, advanced, highly advanced, skillful fashion. You know, these sort of things can cause, you know, significant trauma, which is totally understandable. So that's, you know, why I always sort of tread carefully and as diplomatically as I can with dealing with people, because I understand how it can sort of, you know, bring memories forth which aren't necessarily always good ones. But I mean, but that particular account, I mean, it contains staple parts of so many stories that deal with, you know, people, who, particularly women, you know, who are Rh negative. And one of the most important things that, you know, the person wrote was the fact that this occurs within families. I mean, that's something I've found time and time again. It's like something that goes from grandmother to mother to daughter and so on, as if, you know, this genetic component just continues and continues. And, you know, I couldn't honestly really begin to tell you how many accounts I've got that are extremely similar to that one, even to the point of, you know, the sense of sort of feeling different and having a close encounter and, you know, the doctor finding anomalies as well. It's sort of a, you know, all of these are sort of staple parts of this entire phenomenon. I mean, on the pregnancy thing as well, there's a very, again, disturbing angle, which you could actually even take away from the UFO issue, and it's still disturbing. For example, if you have a man who, let's say, hypothetically, is Rh negative and a woman who's Rh positive, and she gets pregnant by the man, and the, you know, the baby, the fetus starts to develop, and it's Rh negative. Well, although, you know, the mother, the fetus, the growing baby, is nourished by the mother, the two bloodstreams actually don't cross. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, that the bloodstreams are separate. But, you know, obviously the process of nourishing the fetus, you know, that's where the obviously gets that from the mother. However, sometimes during the pregnancy, you know, the doctor may have some concerns or may need to do a procedure, like, for example, what's called amniocentesis, which in simple terms, sort of a needle is inserted to allow, you know, the extraction of blood or cell, etc., to make sure everything's developing carefully and correctly. Now, if during a procedure like that, some of the growing fetus's blood gets into the mother's bloodstream, and the baby is Rh negative and the mother is Rh positive, the mother's immune system actually attacks the unborn fetus to the point where it literally tries to kill it. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. And you know, no pun intended. It sort of treats the fetus as being alien. Now, today, fortunately, this issue can be very easily and quickly avoided by when, you know, the mother gets pregnant and the blood is checked, etc. If it's found that the mother's Rh positive and the fetus is Rh negative, then drugs can be given, medication can be given that very quickly prevents any hassles from occurring. But in a worst case scenario, if these drugs aren't given, what the mother's immune system and antibodies can do is to create a deep state of anemia in the fetus, which in a worst case scenario can actually kill the baby before it's born. So in other words, we have this bizarre situation where the Rh negative and the Rh positive blood groups attack each other. They view them as something totally different to what they are.
Yeah, and you know, I had to read this because I've already disclosed that I'm O negative, but I also have had a hysterectomy due to very painful periods and endometriosis issues with the uterus. I also had a UFO encounter in my mid to late 20s. Mm-hmm. So that really struck home to me. I'm just like, holy cow.
Well, yeah, I mean, but again, I mean, that's important because, you know, you're coming sort of forward now, Marie, and talking about your experiences, which are sort of, you know, sort of eerily parallel by so many others. And I said, it's not just across the board in abductees, with this is being reported, the percentage which are Rh negative and reporting it, you know, far outweighs the people who aren't Rh negative and reporting it.
So now, do you know... can two Rh positives, mother and father, create an Rh negative baby?
Well, there are occasions when it has happened, but typically it occurs when one person is Rh negative. But there have been reports like that, but typically, though, it is when one's Rh negative. Now, you know, as I said, as well as, you know, the sort of the spinal issue and the UFO issue, there are other angles as well. Typically, Rh negatives have slightly lower than normal levels of blood pressure. Their body temperature is slightly lower. Typically, they're not as good at tolerating high temperatures as the rest of the population is. And so there's a lot of intriguing things along these lines, which actually suggest that Rh negative people in many respects are quite different. You know, I don't mean in like a sinister fashion or anything like that. There are just sort of unique properties in their body that make them slightly different. But one of the really interesting things is how, for example, so many people in the UFO subject, even who haven't had profound sort of abduction or contactee experiences, are also Rh negative. Now, I'll give you a good example. I mentioned how this phenomenon sort of goes back to so-called ancient astronaut research eras. And it turns out that some of the most well-known figures in the ancient astronaut research and writing community are Rh negative. For example, arguably the most famous figure in ancient astronaut research, Eric von Daniken, is Rh mm-hmm. negative. Brad Steiger, who's written extensively on ancient mysteries, Atlantis, ancient aliens, that kind of thing. Brad is Rh negative, as is most of his family. The late Robert Anton Wilson, who was heavily involved in UFOs and also fascinated by the idea of alien visitation in the Egyptian times, he was Rh negative. And the list goes on. And this sort of touches on something I talk about in the book, the idea of what's called inherited memory. You know, it's like all of us, to some degree, we sort of inherit traits of our parents, whether it's the shape of your nose, the colour of your eyes, your hair colour, that kind of thing. Then there's this controversial angle. For example, like somebody has an organ transplant, and then they start to develop the food cravings of the person whose organ was transplanted into them, as if some essence of the person has been transferred over. And this relates also to what's called inherited memory, the idea that we can potentially, even though most of the time we don't know or realize it, we can potentially literally inherit fragments of memories. You know, it's not just the shape of your nose or your hair color. It could be a fragment of a distant memory is passed down from a generation. And it would be so fragmentary. It'd be kind of like, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you've had a really profound dream, and as you start to wake up, it starts to fade from your mind, and then it's gone. But it's still on the tip of your tongue. And a lot of researchers now are coming around to the idea that perhaps the Rh negative angle, why people, so many people in ufology are drawn to it, could be that they have fragmentary, deeply buried, deeply rooted memories in their subconscious, which relates back to the early years of sort of genetic manipulation and the original creation of the Rh negatives, to where deep somewhere in our mind there might be fragments of the memories. And that's why the people are drawn to the subject, but they're not able to understand why. Why am I so fascinated by this? But if there is this sort of fragment somewhere in the mind, that might kind of explain it.
Yeah, it would. It's very compelling.
It's a fascinating subject indeed. And the book is called Bloodline of the Gods. And again, you can go to Nick's website, which is Nick Redfern. NickRedfern14.blogspot.com. Again, NickRedfern14.blogspot.com. Pick up a copy of it. Marie, you have a copy of it, and I know you thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been waiting for someone to write a book about it, and to have Nick be the one to do it, it was just epic. It was an excellent book.
Thanks, Marie. Thank you.
Yeah, check it out and pick up a copy for yourself and learn more about this fascinating subject. We do have to take our 9:30 break and take care of a couple of sponsors, but when we come back from the break, we're going to continue the discussion with our guest, Nick Redfern, tonight. And, Nick, I want to get onto the subject of Bigfoot, because I know it's a very vast topic, much like Rh-negative blood and the chupacabra, but we're going to have limited time to talk about it, so I want to jump into that and maybe cover that a little bit. I want to let people know that you're listening to the Para-X Radio Network, IRN, the Internet Radio Network, WAHR-FM, Radio Love, Planet Paranormal, TuneIn Radio, and you're hearing the rebroadcast of our show if you're listening Wednesday nights to the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcast Network. Our guest tonight, Nick Redfern, 14 investigator and author. We're talking about chupacabras, we're talking about Rh-negative blood, and we're going to be talking about Bigfoot after the break. So stick around to BTE Radio's Creature Features. It continues right after this.
The monsters and mayhem will continue with BTE Radio's Creature Features after this.
From the producer of the award-winning documentary Kecksburg, The Untold Story, comes two exciting books on the Pennsylvania UFO, Bigfoot mystery, and cryptozoology. World-renowned UFO investigator and author Stan Gordon presents Silent Invasion, the PA UFO Bigfoot Casebook, and Really Mysterious Pennsylvania. Silent Invasion provides an in-depth look at the 1973 and 1974 UFO Bigfoot flap and covers many of the mysterious incidents during that time, complete with illustrations, photos, and never-before-released details on some of these unusual cases. Read about UFOs and Bigfoot seen at the same time and place, the case of the vanishing Bigfoot, Bigfoot shooting incidents, government interest, and much more. Could Bigfoot be something other than a flesh-and-blood animal? Silent Invasion is a must-have if you want to learn the truth about the strange and mysterious events of 1973 and 1974. Really Mysterious Pennsylvania covers many unusual events and happenings Gordon has investigated over many years. Read accounts and reports of very close-range encounters with mysterious creatures such as Bigfoot, Thunderbirds, Black Panthers, as well as unidentified flying objects. Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook, and Really Mysterious Pennsylvania give you a first-hand look into the strange and mysterious encounters that have taken place in Pennsylvania. Both books are available for purchase on Amazon.com. For autographed copies of the books and the latest news and information about strange happenings and reports throughout Pennsylvania, visit Stan's website at www.stangordon.info. Read Silent Invasion, the PA UFO Bigfoot Casebook, and Really Mysterious Pennsylvania today. Find out why they say sometimes truth.
A storm of campus towards some of our most historic landmarks, like Fort Mifflin in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is the fort that saved America. It held the British at bay while George Washington went upriver to Valley Forge. Now it's in danger of being shut down. There are people who are weathering this storm.
This is Barbara Saletti, co-founder of the Fort Mifflin Historic Preservation Group.
This is Anthony Saletti, co-founder of the Fort Mifflin Historic Preservation Group.
But they can't do it alone. They need our help. Go to www.myspace.com/SaveFortMifflin or www.fortmifflin.com. Together, we can make a difference. Let's save Fort Mifflin and turn the tide of apathy.
Fright Times is not for everyone. If you're not a haunted house and Halloween fan, Fright Times is not for you. If you don't want the techniques, tricks, and tips of leading designers and experts, Fright Times is not for you. And if you want to pay more than $20 a year for a great subscription, seriously, Fright Times? Uh-uh. Otherwise, Fright Times is for you. Cover to cover, the best magazine for haunted house and Halloween fans is Fright Times. Read our back issues online for free at FrightTimes.com. Fright, done right.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to BTE Radio's Creature Features. We've left the lights on for you.
Welcome back to tonight's program. This is BTE Radio's Creature Features, a monthly segment that we do looking at the strange and unusual creatures around the world, the cryptids, the undiscovered creatures, the creatures thought to be extinct. And we always have a guest who specializes in that topic, and tonight is no different, as we have a guest who specializes in quite a bunch of topics. We've covered a few of them here tonight, looking at chupacabras, Rh negative blood, and we're going to be talking about my favorite cryptid, the king of all cryptids, Bigfoot, here in just a minute. Our guest tonight is Nick Redfern, and he's been a guest here at the program with us many, many times. We're so glad that Nick is back with us tonight. His website is very intriguing. There's a lot of great information there that covers his lectures, covers upcoming books. He talks on a variety of different topics, from the UFO phenomenon to Men in Black, to mysterious places around the world, to conspiracies, to pretty much everything. You can check it out for yourself and take a look at some of his blogs that he's written, some of the books he's written. You can order them there as well. Go to nickredfernfortean.blogspot.com, nickredfernfortean.blogspot.com. It's all right there for you to check out. And I follow Nick's blog, and he's always got something great up there that he's written about, and some really cool stories, some interesting news articles, all kinds of great stuff. And Nick, we're glad you're with us tonight. Thanks for coming back to BTE Radio.
Well, thanks, Harry. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Mike.
We're glad you're with us tonight, and especially to talk about some of your more recent books. Now, unfortunately, we won't get to the Men in Black, because that's a very diverse topic in itself, as the first couple were. But I'd like to kind of wrap things up tonight by talking a little bit about, and time permitting, my favorite subject, the hairy hominid known as Bigfoot. You just put out an encyclopedia about Bigfoot called The Bigfoot Book, which is pretty much the only book that you'll really need on the subject, that and John Green's Sasquatch Apes Among Us. This one covers it all.
Well, yeah, the company that I wrote it for, Visible Ink Press, they like to do sort of A to Z books, sort of comprehensive A to Z books, and they asked me if I'd like to do one on Bigfoot. And, yeah, I'm always sort of careful about which sort of book ideas I accept, because, you know, you want to be able to bring something new and a little bit different to the reader. But I thought this was a good one because, you know, it's sort of like just under 400 pages with 200 entries on everything to do with Bigfoot and associated creatures. So in that sense, hopefully, you know, people would sort of perceive it as, you know, as sort of an introduction to the subject, but where, you know, they can learn about not just Bigfoot, but other sort of cryptid apes around the world, you know, without having to go out and buy 30 books on, you know, one on Bigfoot, one on the Yeti, you know, one on the Yeren, one on the Yowie, etc. So, in other words, although, you know, the focus is on Bigfoot, of the 200 entries in the book, you know, you get entries on the Abominable Snowman, the Yeren of China, the Yowie of Australia, Orang Pendek, South American cryptid apes, stories from the UK and different parts of Europe from, you know, 1,000 years ago of so-called wild men. And also, for example, there are entries on Bigfoot in the movies, TV shows, you know, the world of fiction, things like that, and sort of really trying to cover just about every aspect of Bigfoot in, like I said, everything from history, folklore, mythology, science, entertainment, you know, you name it.
Yeah, it's pretty much everything. It's got everything in it.
Well, I tried to cover as much, and even the controversial stuff where, you know, like, for example, where people have claimed to have seen Bigfoot at the same time as a UFO, mm-hmm. or the, you know, people have claimed the creatures become invisible, that kind of thing. And also some of the things like how dogs often, you know, respond with hostility towards Bigfoot. So there's, you know, there's entries on things like that, dogs and Bigfoot. So, you know, I've tried to cover sort of the more well-known aspects, like the Patterson film, but also the far lesser-known ones as well.
I'm really shocked that you will get it under 400 pages. I mean, let's think about it. Realistically, there's so much to this topic, and people don't realize that when they're first getting involved with it, or they just start to follow it. There's so many different avenues and so many different twists and turns, and it's just people ask me, why do you only research Bigfoot, investigate Bigfoot? Well, I look into other phenomenon. I study that too, but Bigfoot in itself is enough for my plate right now.
No, you're right. I mean, like other things I have in the book are the whole issue of tree knocks, mm-hmm. and so-called, you know, the Bigfoot teepees, that kind of thing, you know, these tree structures. You know, footprints, audio recordings. One of the things I talk about in the book was actually the main thing that got me interested, or one of the main things that got me interested as a kid in the UK. was the fact that not too far from where I lived in central England, which is sort of very heavily forested area, there was a story going back of a creature known as the man monkey, which was described as like a large chimpanzee type animal, seen in the 19th century, and nobody knew what it was, but it kind of sounded, for want of a better term, like a mini foot. It's not the best way to describe it. It's sort of like a 5 foot tall chimpanzee ape-like animal, and because this site, the initial sightings or the continuing sightings occurred just a 20-minute drive from where I lived as a kid, everybody in the area knew the legends, and that's one of the things that got me interested. So, in other words, what I've tried to do is also focus on a lot of lesser-known animals. For example, you know, most people, I'm sure, listening to the show will have heard of Orang Pendek, mm-hmm. this small ape-like animal, but that seems to have sort of human overtones attached to it as well, on the island of Sumatra. But there are also a number of other small ape-like creatures reported from Sumatra and other local islands, which sound far more savage and ape-like. So whether we're dealing with distorted accounts of Orang Pendek or two or three different kinds, I'm not sure. But I've sort of been careful to demonstrate to the reader that, you know, where Orang Pendek is reported, we actually get some quite different ones, although, you know, they're sort of a small stature, they actually sound quite different. So there's a lot of, you know, sort of far less well-known ones like that I cover.
That's fantastic. And it's kind of good, in my opinion, to have a book like this out, because the craze of Bigfoot is probably reached its all-time high. Everybody's seems to be in the Bigfoot hunt these days. And you've got television shows, you've got podcasts like mine, Marie's, you've got so many people interested. You know, back in the 70s and 80s and stuff like that, when I was growing up as a kid, there wasn't these types of shows out there. It wasn't.
No, you're right.
There was a few, I mean, In Search Of or, you know, Unsolved Mysteries in the 80s, but there wasn't a lot out there that really focused on it. Now there is. So a book like this is, in my opinion, is perfect for the beginner because, as you say, and say it quite well, it does touch on a lot of different variables to this phenomenon.
Yeah, well, thanks. I appreciate that, Eric. I mean, that's one of the things I've tried to do is point out that, you know, I mean, for the sort of the seasoned research, I mean, I would hope they will get something from it as well, particularly like a lot of the lesser-known stories of, like I said, you know, Indonesian cryptid apes, Indian cryptid apes, other ones from China beyond the Yeren, like smaller ones. So, you know, hopefully it would appeal to, you know, people who have been in the subject for a long time as well. But you're right. I think one of the things I tried to do was, you know, to demonstrate to people who are new to the subject that, you know, you might find this particular entry in the book really interesting. Say on Gigantopithecus, that might then lead someone to buy, like, Lauren Coleman's book, True Giants on Gigantopithecus. You know, the UFO angle might want prompt people to go out and buy Stan Gordon's book, Silent Invasion, which covers sort of the UFO Bigfoot angle. And somebody else might think, wow, the entry they've got on the Yeti is really cool, and that'll spur them on to read more about the Yeti. So that's one of the things I hope, you know, that it might, you know, bring forward more and more people, younger people in their sort of early teens, like when I got involved, you know, and we'll have next generations of researchers coming along and continuing to sort of fly the flag.
Well, I think it's a perfect way to get them started in it and to at least give them, as you said, a kind of a taste of the different ideas and different thoughts that are going on in the field of research. Now, something I've always wanted to ask you, and this does kind of relate to what you've written about in the book, and this is kind of a touchy subject too, because people, especially mainstream hardcore Bigfoot researchers, don't like to look at all aspects of the field. I've always considered myself open-minded, and I look at all avenues and all possibilities, but as of late, in the last 4 or 5 years, the idea of Bigfoot being a paranormal being or an alien hybrid or even an interdimensional being has really come to the forefront. Before, it was pushed under the carpet, and the sightings of Bigfoot and UFOs in the 70s weren't acknowledged. People weren't talking openly about Bigfoot disappearing or the multidimensional thing. Now that it's accepted by science, there are other dimensions. It seems that Bigfoot, the mystery of Bigfoot, has gotten a lot deeper, and it seems that it's become more strange, if you will. We're not dealing with an animal anymore. We could be dealing with anything. What are your thoughts on this sudden embracement of this mysterious aspect of Bigfoot, or the paranormal aspect of Bigfoot?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is an area that's fascinated me for a long time. I mean, you know, sort of go back to the one I talked about in England, the man monkey.
Mm-hmm.
That has a sort of a classic paranormal aspect to it. The first case that was reported was a guy crossing a bridge in January 1879 with his horse and cart, and this creature loomed out of the woods and attacked him, and he charged at him, and he reportedly went to hit it with the horse's whip, and reportedly the whip went straight through it as if it was like a spectral kind of thing. And I said, growing up, you know, just a short distance from where all that happened, it was sort of a well-known story in the area. But, I mean, I get a lot of accounts like this, and I think, you know, if you write about the Chupacabra or somebody else writes about Ogopogo, people have a sighting, they search you out on the internet, and they contact you based on the sort of things that's relevant to what they've seen. Which is why I don't get many Ogopogo reports, you know. But I do get a lot of reports, because I've written about quite extensively on the paranormal aspect of Bigfoot. I do get a lot of reports. And, you know, what I always tell people is that there's a lot of people in the Bigfoot field doing a great deal of really good research. But when it comes down to it, the most important people of all are the witnesses. You know, it's not the authors, it's not the blogs, it's the witnesses. And, you know, I get a lot of reports from people who come across as highly credible who said words, you know, to the effect that they saw a Bigfoot and it sort of faded away in front of them, or it vanished in a flash of light, or the creature looked at them and it was as if the person felt destabilized, where they went dizzy and lightheaded and fell to their knees. And this kind of ties in with some of the theories about Bigfoot having the ability to direct infrasound, this very low sound, in essence, which basically the way it works is that infrasound can affect the human nervous system. It's very low frequency sound. It's sort of like being in front of a, you know, in a rock concert, you're right at the front, you can feel that thumping, but it gets much lower than that. It can cause nausea, can destabilize a person, etc., etc. I've heard a lot of people tell me stories like that, you know, that they felt that these creatures in hindsight were destabilizing them with infrasound. Now, where, you know, I agree with most people in, you know, the world of Bigfoot seeking, is that we all agree that Bigfoot exists. You know, I'm not a debunker, I'm not a skeptic, I'm absolutely 100% certain Bigfoot as a species of some kind exists. However, I do personally think there's more to Bigfoot than just being nothing more than a North American equivalent of an African gorilla. I think there are enough sort of rogue cases that suggest there's something else going on. And for me, you know, I don't force feed my views down people's throats, because I think that's the wrong way to do it. What I do is present the data and say, here's what I've found, here's the theories. You know, where does it lead? And I think that's the responsible way of doing it, you know, rather than sort of thumping on the table and saying Bigfoot is interdimensional. You know, I think the responsible way is to say, well, these witnesses are suggesting something that potentially offers the possibility it is interdimensional. So let's look more into what multi-dimensions are and how the science behind it works. And I think that's the important thing. But I get it, you know, a lot of people do take the view that this is just an unknown ape and they don't want to deal with the weirder stuff. But for me, you know, I don't want to be selective with what the witnesses tell me. You know, if one person tells me they saw this thing catching a hog in the woods, well, yes, that sounds more like a regular down-to-earth animal of an unknown kind. Somebody else tells me that they saw this creature vanish in a flash of light. From my perspective, I'm going to investigate both cases from, you know, with a rational, logical approach, and treat the witnesses with the respect that I would give the other witness. You know, I don't buy with the idea of, well, that's just crazy, so I'm going to write it off if the guy was just drunk or stoned or whatever. No, I think it's important to listen to the witnesses and not be selective.
So. I think that's missing these days. I do agree that more and more researchers are opening their mind and looking at all avenues of research. I think that's very important, because we don't really have an answer as to what it is after 50 some years, maybe 60 years of looking into the phenomenon. We don't have any conclusive answers. All we have really are assorted footprints, the screams and calls, the eyewitness testimony, and maybe some tufts of hair that haven't been positively identified. So we don't have a lot in the way of hard physical evidence. So I think it's very important to keep an open mind to the subject.
But I think, you know, the important thing is, regardless of, you know, all the different theories, we all pretty much agree that this is a real phenomenon, you know, and I think that's what unifies us. But, I mean, what I would sort of really love is if somebody put a conference on where they'd have somebody talking about the Gigantopithecus angle, somebody else talking about the idea of, you know, a primitive human survived, but then somebody else talking about infrasound, and then the next one talking about multi-dimensions, and have it really, you know, an alternative Bigfoot conference where all the theories get discussed rather than it just being, you know, well, we're going to cover this, but we're not going to invite anybody who dares to talk about that, you know?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, most of those kinds of things would end up in fistfights and screaming and hollering because people are so passionate about their beliefs.
Well, they would, but then on the other hand, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with having a good, you know, debate. And if it gets confrontational, well, audiences like that. You know, there's nothing wrong with the way I look at it. There's nothing wrong with having a good sort of verbal fist fight and actually possibly achieving something at the end of the day. And if on top of that you can all just agree to have a beer and hang out at the bar at the end of the event, well, all the better. You know, I think we should recognise this is a real phenomenon, but it doesn't hurt to really have raised voices and air different highly controversial thoughts, but at the end of the day, agree to disagree. There's no, you know, that's how it should be, I think.
I'm in agreement with you. I'm in agreement with you, Nick. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's 5 minutes to 10, and we've got to wrap things up here. But before we say goodnight, first, I'd like personally to thank you for coming on tonight and talking with us. And this hour and a half with you just flew by so fast. So I'm going to ask you, as I have before in the past, will you come back again on the show?
Yeah, sure. Just let me know when you got a free time, and yeah, and I'll be happy to be on. So, yeah.
Fantastic. We'd love to have you back on to talk more about these interesting subjects. Secondly, I'd like to ask, do you have any upcoming projects or any new books in the works or anything that you can share with us?
Yeah, I've actually got a couple of books coming out next year. One, you mentioned the Men in Black book. Well, one of the lesser-known aspects of this, but which is tied in, is Women in Black stories. I've got a lot.
Yeah.
It's almost identical, and I've got a book called Women in Black coming out next year, and also I've got a book coming out on the Loch Ness Monster, which actually looks at the sort of the a lot of the weirder aspects of the Loch Ness Monster story, with ties in with UFO sightings and even Men in Black reports and Aleister Crowley having a house at Loch Ness. So it looks at sort of the weird, it's the whole weird history of Loch Ness, never mind just Nessie.
So yeah. You're keeping busy, as always.
Trying to. Keep you out of trouble sometimes.
Any upcoming events or places you'll be lecturing?
Yeah, I'm speaking at the in February at the UFO Congress in Arizona, where I'll be speaking on the Men in Black mystery. That'll be the sort of the next sort of major thing in the U.S. I forget the exact day, but if you Google UFO Congress Arizona, you'll find the website, and I said I'll be speaking on the new book, Men in Black, at that one.
Awesome. Very awesome indeed, my friend. Well, thank you again for coming on, Nick. How can people get a hold of you if they have questions, if they want to friend you or on Facebook?
Yeah, sure. Well, people can reach me at my blog, as you said, which is nickredfernfortean, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, nickredfernfortean.blogspot.com, or they can tweet me, or they can reach me at Facebook as well. I think there's like 7 or 8 Nick Redferns on Facebook, but scroll through and you'll find me. And yeah, if people want to send me messages, you know, I'm always happy to chat, or if they've got questions or, you know, want advice on something, and yep, I'm always happy to sort of, you know, answer anything that I can, if I can.
Yeah, you've always been very approachable to me and answer anything I've had questions on, so it's always appreciated.
Well, I always like to look at it, you know, we're all in it together, you know. We need to sort of and take that approach that none of us are bigger than the subject. We're all looking for the answers.
That's a good way to look at it. My friend, I want to thank you for coming on again. We really appreciate your time and talking with us, and we'll get you back on here pretty soon.
All right. Thanks, Barry. Thanks, Marie.
Thank you.
Nick Redfern joining us tonight on the show. What a great show tonight, Marie.
Oh, I always love talking to Nick.
And me too. Great guy, and very, very knowledgeable on a lot of subjects. It's not just Bigfoot or Chupacabras. I mean, he's got long list of books that he's written, and he talks about on his blog, nickredfern14.blogspot.com. Check that out. Order his books. If you're fascinated by the subjects like we talked about tonight, plus any others, I'm sure you'll find it in his library of books he's authored.
Yeah, and I'm glad he mentioned the two that are coming up, too, because I'm looking forward to both of those.
Women in Black.
The Women in Black, yeah, and the Loch Ness Monster, both of them.
Yeah, should be interesting reads when they come out. And my birthday will be in August, so that we can work on getting those books for my birthday in August.
I'll remember that.
I'm working on the ones for Christmas now, the Bigfoot book and the Bloodline of the Gods and, oh, my gosh, the Chupacabra Road Trip I've got. He's got so many out. It's hard to keep up with him.
I'd have a whole bookshelf full of his books if I had them all.
Oh, without doubt, without doubt. Mm-hmm. But we've got to call it a night, make way for our next show here on Para X. We want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight and remind everybody that next week on the show, it will be another paranormal news and discussion episode with Chris Nicastro. He's lining up the stories as we speak, and should be a fun show, Marie.
Hijinks galore.
Always. Always. We always have fun talking with Chris and cracking jokes and having fun with it, keeping the stories light and friendly.
Exactly.
All right, folks, we got to hit the road. I want to thank everybody again for tuning in tonight to Beyond the Edge Radio's Creature Features. Hopefully we'll have Karen back with us next month. And we were supposed to have on with us tonight the folks from the Haunted Spotlight, Sean and Marianne Donnelly, but they're up at the Lizzie Borden House up in Massachusetts. So, but they'll be back in December, and we'll look forward to talk with them. We got to hit the road, folks. Anything before we go, Marie?
Hi-ho, Silver!
And away. Thanks for tuning in to tonight's program. This is BTE Radio, and you can catch us live every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. here on the Para X Radio Network, IRN, the Internet Radio Network, WAHR-FM, Radio Love, Planet Paranormal, and TuneIn Radio. And if it's Wednesday nights, you can hear the rebroadcast of the show on the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcast Network. For Marie Samuels, I'm Eric Altman. You guys have a great night, and we'll see you next week.
Tonight's show can be heard on Wednesday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the IPBN-FM, the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcast Network. Archives of tonight's show and all BTE radio programs can be heard on the following networks: iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podomatic, Podbean, Parapods, TuneIn Radio, Blueberry Podcasting, Planet Paranormal, the IPBN, and Para-X Radio Networks. Music used during tonight's show was done with the express written permission and performed by the following artists: Midnight Syndicate at MidnightSyndicate.com, The Kill Creeps at LyleBlackburn.com, The Moon Rays at TheMoon-Rays.com, Shane Spiel and the Snake Oil Band at ShaneSpiel.com, The Iacolytes at TheIacolytes.Bandcamp.com. For questions, feedback, or to contact us, email us at BeyondTheEdgeRadio@gmail.com or visit our website at BeyondTheEdgeRadio.com. BTE Radio's Creature Features is a Beyond the Edge Entertainment production, heard only on Beyond the Edge Radio.